Hi everybody, I'm Steve Pearce. I work with lawyers on career transformation. And in the last year, I've seen a real increase in people coming to me saying they want a completely different direction. Maybe you're in that category. Maybe you're fed up with the 24/7, always on culture. Maybe you just want to do something completely different, shake things up. This podcast, Project Pivot, is all about lawyers who change it up. We'll be sharing a whole range of stories, from people who've started their own business to people who've retrained as psychotherapists or teachers. And I'm really looking forward to sharing these stories with you. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. One of the main frustrations people feel about their day-to-day roles is that they don't feel like they're doing meaningful work, or they don't feel like they're doing work that aligns with their personal values. That's where I think our guest today, Catherine Grum, has plenty to teach us. She seems to have identified her personal values pretty early on and made sure that all of her subsequent roles are in alignment, whether that's in a series of high-profile roles at large professional firms, or more recently as she started her own business, or indeed her work as a trustee. I know you're going to enjoy the interview. Let's get into it. Okay, well, let's get into it. So, I mean, it's a stellar career. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So, you know, Oxford, Barclays, A&O, of course, as well, KPMG, BDO. The theme running through it all, it seems to me, is private client and family office. So can you just sort of start us off by just shedding a bit of light as to why that was a specialism? Why was that something you concentrated on from quite early on?
Yeah, certainly I started right from Allen & Overy being interested in the private client sphere. And for me, it was a mix of a number of different reasons. So it, as an area of law, it's quite technical because you've got the laws around trusts and estate planning, but there's also a tax overlay. And at the same time, you're working with individuals, so people who are directly impacted by the advice that you're giving. And it's more of a manageable size client. So when I was at Allen & Overy and I was doing my trainee rotations, you also spend time in the corporate team. I did certainly in the litigation team, where the clients were huge. And until you got to quite a senior level, it was hard to see your individual or feel your individual impact. Whereas from private client, right from day one, I had my own files. There was a partner responsible for them, but those were my clients that I was running and leading.
So it's that personal contact that really mattered to you. That was why you wanted to pursue that.
Yeah. I mean, when I was choosing, I did a law degree. And when I was looking into options, my first choice had actually been to try and do law and psychology. So I'd always been interested in the human side. There were very few courses available, so I ended up dropping that idea. But right from the, you know, before starting out my career, I was always interested in that too.
Right. This is very interesting. So let's look at this in a bit more detail, because from the outside in, it would seem to me that this kind of work actually is, it requires quite almost a niche skill set, because as you were saying, dealing with large organizations and corporate life, and you know, obviously that has its complexity and many challenges as well. But once you start introducing families, large amounts of money, it seems to me that the skill set you require is quite specific. So the relationship management side of it, I'm making an assumption, so by all means you'll tell me what the truth is, but the relationship management of it would seem to be more important than the technical bit.
I wouldn't say it was necessarily more important, but it's a critical component. And if I think of people who've trained as private client lawyers and remained as private client lawyers who I really respect, they are very sharp intellectually and have a very good grasp of all the technical aspects, but they've also got a good way of explaining it to clients and listening to clients. So, it's critical to have both. It's very difficult. There isn't much space for a private client lawyer who doesn't interact with clients. And clients are, unlike in the corporate realm, you know, you're not dealing with sophisticated buyers. And I mean them no disrespect, but often when they are coming to you for advice, it's in an area that they are not, it's not their day job. Whereas if you're dealing on the corporate side, typically your counterparts, it's their day job too, albeit they're coming at it from a different angle. So you have to approach it in a slightly different way from how you would do if you were working just with corporates or banks.
So what are they looking for then? What given what you've just said, that they're not necessarily going to have expertise in areas of law, what really helps with relationship building at that level?
They're really looking for a guide. And I'd say this is one of the things that I've been reflecting on recently as my career has kind of continued to evolve. And it's something I perhaps didn't appreciate as fully at the outset, because there's quite a power imbalance. So as an advisor, you understand the nuances. You understand that there's typically advice on a spectrum, you know, whether it's tax advice or whether it's how you plan your affairs. And you can see the whole spectrum because you've seen clients in different positions before. But if you're sat on the client side, you really, you've got blinkers on, really. You know, you're right up close to detail. It's your family business. It's your family. And often you can't see the options. And then you've got an advisor coming in and the advisor says, oh, you should do this. There is an awful lot of influence in that direction. That I don't think advisors historically have necessarily fully appreciated and spent enough time with clients really helping them to see the big picture at the outset and understanding and trying to set the direction they want to travel in before they start putting the building blocks in place that the lawyers do, that once they start working with them, it's a little bit harder to kind of take a step back and say, hang on, we're going in the wrong direction.
So there's a lot of responsibility on you and there's a need to really pace that conversation.
Yeah, and it's really important as well not to make assumptions about what the clients are looking to achieve. And again, that's something that I've been reflecting on a lot in the past few years, how easy it is, and give you an example around tax planning, to assume that every client wants to, within the bounds of what's legal and what's acceptable from society's perspective, they want to minimise their tax. And that isn't always true. And they don't necessarily understand, if you're giving them advice around that, exactly what decision they're making. And that's why I think you've seen, you know, in the press historically, the stories of famous people who have sailed too close to the wind in their tax planning. Typically, they've not gone and said, oh, I've got this really clever idea about my tax. They've been working with a professional and they haven't necessarily appreciated. Some may have, and I'm not talking about any specific individual case, but I think on the whole, they haven't necessarily understood where the spectrum is and where they've been. They've just been kind of guided by an advisor who they trust. So kind of reflecting on that, a lot of the work that I do now, and I know we'll obviously come into that in the rest of this conversation, but a lot of it's really at the outset of that journey, trying to make sure that they make informed decisions about the direction they want to travel in before you start designing the route for them.
Okay, so we've got a sort of clear sense of your market and who the clients are. I suppose then it becomes a question of which platform you're going to use to access and serve that market. So you decided not to stay in a sort of conventional law firm framework. Why was that?
It was a very sort of gradual progression, really. So my first move directly outside the law was on secondment to Barclays. And so that was really kind of, in my mind, no risk. You go for 6 months, you see what it's like on a slightly different side of the fence. And I wasn't, and traditionally often when you go in on secondment, you go into an in-house legal team. I wasn't. I was actually into a sort of a client-facing advisory team. And I loved it. You know, I loved the work. I loved having the slightly broader conversations with the clients. And before going on to secondment, I had no intention of leaving my team at Allen & Overy. I, you know, really respected the partners there. I really enjoyed the work. I really liked team and colleagues, and they're still now some of my best friends. But it was those broader conversations that I was having that made me think, hang on a minute, actually there is maybe life outside the law, or outside the law as I knew it, working in the narrow kind of box that you put in when you're in a big firm. It was a little kind of baby step outside. And then at the end of my 6 months, I'd always intended to go back to Allen & Overy, but it was around the time of 2008 and the financial crisis. And actually Allen & Overy did a big restructuring. And as part of that, the private client team left the firm to set up independently. So at that point, I was never going back to Allen & Overy. It was either staying at Barclays or going to join them in their new firm. And I felt I got some really good advice from my dad at the time, because I was really torn. Because as I said, I really enjoyed the work I was doing. I really liked the team. There was no push factor for me to want to leave. But I'd had my eyes opened at Barclays to a slightly broader role and a slightly broader, slightly different use of my skills. And he basically said to me, don't think of it as a right or wrong decision, because you'll tie yourself up in knots trying to make the right decision. Think of it as two paths. Both paths are good. Both paths will end up with you probably in good positions. They're just different paths. And actually that really helped me to be able to say, okay, you know what? I'm going to stay on the Barclays path for now. I'm enjoying it. And at the time, only 6 months in, as long as I didn't burn any bridges, I wasn't closing any doors at that point. And it's basically been a gradual progression since then away from the law.
So what is the thread going forward? So you like those wider conversations, rather than it just being the sort of, narrowly scoped in the law. Is that the key to the transitions you've made after that?
Yeah, I think it really is. So, when I was making that decision, I looked at all the good private client lawyers that I knew, and there were plenty of them. And, they had, as I said, those both the dual skill set, the relationship and the technical knowledge. But I felt that there was a gap really or at least clients weren't getting that as much, that being able to step back a step or step up a step actually and get that perspective looking down about, you've got a blank sheet of paper in front of you, where do you want to go? Often with the lawyers that's happened in a conversation, but what I found when I was at Barclays was that they really wanted to pause there for a while. And for whatever reason, but those conversations I could see, because I knew the clients I was working with had lawyers, but they weren't having them with those lawyers. And therefore I felt there was a gap there. And I know that the clients really valued it. And I basically describe it as helping them with like a completely blank sheet of paper and drawing a map for them. So, were they a family that liked spending time in the mountains? Did they like the countryside? Did they like the beach life? And once they'd understood there was a map and those were the different areas or different directions they could go in, then you could start to say, well, if you want to go to the mountains, there are these paths that you could take. And again, they could then start to understand, well, it's not just one direct route, there's different paths. And when they had an idea of that, at that point, they then needed the technical advisors who would then build that path for them, drill down much more into their own nuances of their own situations to work out, exactly how to make that route work for them and their family. But it was that I found that often, and I think this is as much on the client side as it was on the lawyer side, but the conversation started at kind of point three rather than point one. So that's really where I kind of wanted to develop and do more. And I like that kind of helping with those bigger, more strategic conversations. And I also felt that spending time, it aligned more with my values as well, because I wanted to help those families be more purposeful with their wealth, so really understand that yes, they've had business success or they've inherited and they've got a significant amount of wealth, but that's not the end goal. That's a tool for them to achieve other things, whether it's for themselves individually or their family, but also for communities, so things like philanthropy. I wanted to enable those conversations to happen at the right moment in time. So then when the planning was done, it was done on this foundation of understanding that the family knew they'd had their eyes open, they'd made informed decisions about where they were now, where they wanted to go.
Really interesting, actually, when you say that it aligns with your own values, because, in the process of this project, talking to people about, you know, the way their careers have developed, you know, sometimes the sort of catalyst for a major pivot is the realization that actually the work they're doing doesn't align with their values. You know, it may be, you know, it's great in terms of remuneration or status or whatever, but on a deeper level in terms of values, there is perhaps less alignment. But for you, you recognized that early on and managed to shape it so that the two things were pretty consistent.
Yeah, I don't know if I recognized it early on, but sort of reflecting back as to why I made shifts and moves, I can see where it fits in. So, you know, for example, on my dad's side, my granddad was a miner up in Northumberland. And I've always found it strange that the miner's granddaughter has ended up advising some of the wealthiest families, not just in the UK, but in the world. And I like the fact that if I'm working with those families and you know, I believe in successful business, I believe in people being able, within the bounds of the law, to plan their affairs. But I didn't necessarily want to be the one doing the tax planning if families did want to take more of an approach to minimising their taxes. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what I personally wanted to be doing. And therefore, having those conversations more about, well, what's this wealth for? And actually, in some instances, helping families to realise that they've got surplus to their needs, even if they look generations ahead, and then opening up those conversations about, well, what does that mean? What might you want to do with those funds? Do you therefore need to take the same approach to tax that you thought you were doing? Do you want to look into philanthropy more? And helping them kind of really expand their perspectives at that stage. And so that feels good to me.
Hi, everyone. This is Steve interrupting the interview very quickly just to say that if you are considering a career change of any kind, why not check out our website at projectpivot.co.uk, where we've got a whole range of free resources for you that I think you might find helpful. So do check it out, projectpivot.co.uk. Let's get back to the interview. Given that family heritage that you've just touched on, is it an environment? Obviously, you're dealing with ultra high net worth individuals. You've always felt comfortable in that environment, or you know, has that been a process?
I've never, because I guess I started in private client right at the start of my career, and you know, when you're a small kind of trainee lawyer, all the clients seem big, whether it's an individual or whether it's a corporate. So actually, at that point, they seem less kind of up on a pedestal than some of the big companies that, you know, firms like Allen & Overy deal with. I remember when in my corporate training seat doing a transaction that we would do, the client would acquire shares and then we'd go back to our desks, refresh the BBC website until the news appeared that they'd acquired the shares. So, you know, it's all kind of, if you're working in a big firm in London, they're kind of frontline clients, if you like.
So let's fast forward a little. So the years spent at KPMG and then at BDO, where you're head of the family office, what happens then? Tell us about the next transition, which sounds like quite an interesting one.
Yeah, so I kind of, my career, for the most part, stayed in and around professional service firms and certainly, you know, large firms. And I became more of a consultant. So in KPMG and BDO, I was advising clients, helping them think about their wealth strategy in the largest sense. So what do they want to do with it? If they needed something like a family office, what did that need to do? So being very purposeful in the planning before you started putting the building blocks in place, and also working with the individuals around, well, if it's a family enterprise and there's shared wealth, how do they communicate and work that out so that they don't end up as a family falling out over the wealth? Because unfortunately, that's all too common. And again, it was something that I was quite passionate about, that I don't want, you know, family's really important to me. And I hate the idea of other families falling out over wealth. It seems like the worst, because it's not doing them any good, and it's certainly not doing anyone else any good. So again, that was part of what drove me to help with those conversations. But then, yeah, I enjoyed my time. Again, I've been really fortunate. I've worked with great people all throughout my career. But it came, there was a point, I guess the tipping point for me was, and suddenly my mother-in-law passed away just over a year ago now. And up until that point, I'd been, you know, I talk about big firms, you kind of fit in a box in a big firm or you don't. And I never, because I was doing these services that weren't, they weren't the kind of the bread and butter of the firm, I never quite fitted into the box. I was always trying to bend things and explain what I did. And it was always just that little bit harder. And also my model, it's very time intensive with clients. It doesn't scale in the same way that if you're, BDO, if you're giving advice to either a corporate or an individual, typically you've got a partner and then a team below them supporting them. Whereas for me, there would never be that same kind of size or scale team. And the work that I was doing was complementary. And that was the vision. That was why I joined them, to be sort of work collaboratively with them. But there was just, as I said, that kind of never quite fitting into the model. And then when my mother-in-law passed away, it was kind of a wake-up call to me that you only get one life. And then rather than spending the next couple of years trying to make this work, actually, maybe I could be a bit braver and make a leap out on my own and try and carve it out in a way that I wanted to do, where I wasn't trying to fit in anyone else's boxes. And I could be really, again, true to my values and purposeful about how I set it up and what I did.
And is that about the work and the way you structure the work, or is that how you want work to be as part of your life? I'm trying to understand what the key drivers are there.
I guess it's a bit of both, really. So being able to structure the work in a way that works best, and clients like the more independent model, particularly the sort of conversations I'm having with them, I didn't expect that to be a piece of feedback, but it was quite consistently from the clients that I spoke to. And I left BDO on brilliant terms, and they, the clients that wanted to left with me because BDO weren't going to try and replicate that work. So they're happy BDO clients, but then they're saying to me, but we like your model and we like the fact that you're doing it independently. So there's clearly something about that. And, in big firms, they have all the metrics set up for trying to manage a big firm. You have kind of, you need, because you've got so many people with the risk and with the financial aspects that have these big kind of guardrails and says, well, you fit in this box because that's how we manage risk and that's how we manage the profitability and the economics. So being able to say, actually, you know what, I'm going to quote this fee to a client for this piece of work, and I think it's a fair fee. And it might take a little bit more time, it might take a little bit less time, but I'm not going to have to go back to the client and say, well, actually, you know what, I spent an extra couple of hours, it's going to be an extra, when I can see this being a long-term relationship with them. So that's kind of, that's a very practical example of how for me, it felt easier. And I could fit things in amongst my time frame. And so it's also from a personal perspective. I mean, I'm still working hard. I still, I haven't worked any less hard. If anything, I've worked harder since I've left. So it's not kind of, it wasn't about reducing the amount of work I did in any way, but all the work I've done is meaningful. Whereas, again, in the big firm, you've got to deal with some of the compliance and the hoops and the trainings and the meetings that, again, didn't really, I wasn't adding value to those processes and they weren't adding much value to me. So freeing up that time to apply it in other ways has been great.
So autonomy and freedom and control and the ability to, set your own parameters as you described it there. Yeah, okay. How's it been going?
It's been going, really well so far. No, I haven't regretted it.
How many?
We're still, I think this is month 8, something like that. So it's still early days. But as the reception I've had from clients has been great and really positive. I think previously, because I did think before I joined KPMG, which would have been probably nearly 10 years ago now, I did think about doing this and going as a consultant. But I think at that point in time, I hadn't established my own brand. And I think it would have been a very hard route. I had some good contacts, but I didn't have quite the same brand or experience. And so, while I was at KPMG and BDO, that big firm brand was like my hallmark of quality for clients. So if I was speaking to a client, they would assume, because I was a senior person at a very well-respected firm, that I could do what I was saying I was doing. The question was more, did they want what I was offering?
Yeah.
And was it a good relationship fit? Because obviously working with families and talking to them really about some of their most important assets, you've got to have a good relationship fit. Yeah, right, back to what we were saying right at the beginning. So I had that kind of the hallmark there. Whereas now, I think, you know, 10 years on, I've got clients and testimonials and things like that, and I've got a bigger personal brand. So I think for me, now it's been much easier to make that transition. And a lot of people from big firms feel very comfortable and confident referring to me as an individual. Whereas I think 10 years ago, they would have been perhaps more hesitant referring their precious clients to somebody who wasn't as well known.
What about the, you know, the lack of the machine, the sort of, you know, the marketing and the IT and the, all of that support system that, that comes with a big firm? Have you missed that?
Bits of it. So on the marketing side, I used to do a lot of that, a lot of the business development myself anyway, because, again, I didn't fit in a neat box. So I had to do most of the legwork, even if I wanted some support with marketing. I had to do the materials and work it out. And also, I was quite interested in that. So that is no different. I don't have an IT team, and that is definitely a big gap. Which I'm hoping to fill next week, actually, with somebody who's going to come and help me, just obviously on a consulting basis. But there are so many people out there that can help you. And one of the things I've really found that's been so lovely is so many people who've trodden this path before me reached out, particularly in the first kind of few months, and said, I'd love to have a chat. I've got this person that can help with this. I've got that person that can help with that. So, for example, the IT guy came for referral from a headhunter who'd set up her own business. You know, so it's quite a nice supportive community, particularly kind of female entrepreneurs.
I absolutely get that you weren't coming from, say, a big corporate team in legal specialism terms. But the fact that it's just you, I'm assuming, that's an assumption. I assume it's just you, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So is that an issue at all? You know, that sort of, what do you do for a sounding board when you just want to have a chat in confidence about something you're working on and, you know, there isn't necessarily a group of other partners to do that?
Yeah, well, I didn't really have that before because the partners had different areas of expertise from mine. So obviously it depended on what the issue was, and they were very supportive, but it's not like I could say, right, this client, I've got this problem, I'm going to approach it like this, what do you think? So I'm not missing that. And actually, people who would technically be my competitors are also very supportive. It's quite a niche industry. There's probably, I'd say, less than 10 people in the country that do this sort of work at a high level, at least that I'm aware of, and forgive me, there may be more out there. But, you know, a lot of those want this to be a successful niche, you know, service for clients and are quite supportive. So actually, there've been times when if I've needed to bounce it off somebody, I've sent a couple of emails and, you know, I've had somebody that I could talk it through and, you know, without breaching confidences. So it's not, that is the one thing. It would be nice, and I probably wouldn't have left if I had somebody who'd been doing this for the last, you know, 20 years of their career that I could work with and learn from. But I was ploughing that furrow myself already. So
it's fairly early days, but is there anything in you that already wishes you'd done it, you know, 3 years earlier?
I think for me, it was the right time, as I said, because I did get a lot of support, and it was, you know, the clients that I got through working in a big firm have really given me that kind of stepping stone that I wouldn't have had otherwise. So for me, it feels like the right time. But funnily enough, I spoke to somebody else who only left a few years they're older than me and they only left a couple of years ago to go into this role independently. And they were saying, yeah, they wish they'd left at my age. So, I definitely feel like it's the right time to do it.
Let's just touch on the other work that you do. So you're on the board of trustees at the Beacon Collaborative. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah. At the moment, I'm acting chair of the charity. But it's a charity. And again, it'll fit in with the story and hopefully make perfect sense. But it's a charity that aims to double the amount of money that the ultra high net worth in the UK give to charity. So it's kind of an infrastructure charity, if you like, rather than a frontline one, and works trying to lobby government, trying to raise awareness, working with philanthropists and working with other bits of the philanthropy ecosystem to try and get it to be more collaborative and more effective, so that wealthy who, you know, there's a lot of people who would like to give more to charity, but often something stops them, and that's what we're trying to address.
Can you just talk to me a bit about the role of a trustee? Because I think people listening to this will be interested in it, because they might be thinking, look, there's something I'd like to do a bit extra in my life that maybe is, going back to your earlier point, a little more closer aligned with, you know, what matters to me or is meaningful to me. And it always seems to me that actually, you know, trusteeship is one of those vehicles that you know, could be explored more.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It's a real privilege to be a trustee of a charity, and I get as much out of it as I put into it, I think it's fair to say. So, again, it was something that I'd thought about doing for a while, but I'd always, changing jobs or I was having kids, and I was never quite ready to make the jump. And then I started it not long after I joined BDO, because I thought there's always going to be something. There's always going to be some reason why this is a next year project. And the opportunity came up at Beacon, which was just such a perfect fit for my skills and my interest. And so I was like, well, this is too good to let go by. And that came through, they were advertising through another charity that was in my kind of orbit, if you like. But yeah, you understand and you have impact in a very different way. And your role is very different. You're a decision maker. And I think certainly from a lawyer's perspective, you're always giving advice. And this is what I often hear from clients. And I don't think lawyers are doing anything wrong in this regard at all. But the clients always say, oh, well, you know, the lawyers kind of sit on the fence and they just tell me like the pros and cons, but they never give me any guidance. And I was like, well, that's their job. And, you know, they're not in the driving seat. They don't have the commercial knowledge of, you know, the clients, so that it's right that they shouldn't be the ones making those decisions, I think. But then when you're a charity trustee, you are making those decisions, and I think that's a really good skill set to either to learn or to develop and hone in on. And when you're kind of saying, right, okay, I'm going to make this call, first couple of times it's like, okay, there's no one else here, I'm actually kind of, you know, on the hook for it, because, you know, you do bear a lot of responsibility as a charity trustee, but then you also learn a lot. And, you know, things like the accounts, I'm not particularly a numbers person. I think they were hoping that I might have been, because I was obviously working in BDO at the time, and I was like, but you know, you're reviewing and you're signing off on the accounts, but you're also involved in the charity strategy. So I think it's a great way to develop. And so I'm now acting chair, and I have been for the last, again, probably 8-9 months. It coincided with when I left BDO and set up my own business, and I wouldn't recommend necessarily doing both those leaps at the same time. But again, you know, it's a role that I've kind of, it's stretched me, but in a good way, and I think it's healthy to do that. And you know, if people are interested in trustee roles, there's lots of great organisations out there. There's an organisation called Getting On Board that's worth looking at, and they do training and send a lot of information. There's another one. So the agency that we use to recruit trustees is called New Role, N-U-R-O-L-E, and they're good. We use them because they've got quite a diverse network, so they're not going to the usual suspects. So just two areas for people to look out for if they're interested.
Brilliant. So what's the plan going forward? Is it to stay pretty small as you've got it at the moment, or do you see yourself hiring other people, or what's the plan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in any rush to hire other people at the moment. I think that puts additional pressure on. For me, I don't mind if it's kind of, lumpy work and I bill one month and then I don't bill the next month, because I can plan and I can manage that. Whereas if you've got people who are dependent on you, it's a very different feeling. But I wouldn't rule it out in the sort of medium to long term. It's interesting, lots of people have approached me, they want to collaborate with me. So they have lots of kind of other independents who think I might have complementary skills, which again is very flattering. At the moment, I've kind of resisted that because I just want to understand and establish exactly what I'm doing first. But I want to share more and have more of an impact around that, helping people be more purposeful about their wealth. And you can work one-on-one with a family, but I'm interested in how I can try and scale that and make sure that more families and more advisors also are thinking about it in terms of, the wealth is a tool and what do they want to use that tool for before they start designing structures that kind of wrap it up in nice pretty boxes and bows.
And on that, on wealth, I mean, you're so well positioned to comment on this. I mean, does great wealth bring great happiness?
It's a real double-edged sword. So there have been a lot of studies on wealth and happiness, and they've found through these studies that if you are in a financially challenged situation, then greater wealth will is likely to increase your happiness. So if you're worried about paying the mortgage, you're worried about putting food on the table, clearly in those instances, if you can increase someone's levels of wealth, it should hopefully have a material impact on them. But that kind of tails off at something less, I think it's around $75,000 a year of salary. Over and above that, it doesn't seem to have nearly the same correlation. And I think over that point, part of the reason is, at that level, you can go on the holiday, you can, obviously if you've overstretched yourself on a mortgage, that can happen at whatever level of wealth. But in theory, you can buy a house, or you can be confident that you've got that security. You've got enough money, hopefully, to be going on holiday and doing things like that. And at that point, then it's, well, you could always go on a more expensive holiday. You could always buy a more expensive car. You could always buy a more expensive bottle of wine. And as you do that, then someone else is always buying a more expensive one than you. And so from the material perspective, that does have quite a big impact. It's not going to make you happier. But a lot of people chase that for a long time, thinking that they'll feel more fulfilled if they just get this car, or they just have this house. You've got to look underneath if you're chasing the fulfillment and happiness through going through those sorts of metrics. And where they've got very significant wealth within a family, it really is a double-edged sword, because clearly it gives them opportunities that it doesn't give people without that level of wealth. I'm not going to deny that at all. But it can, if it's not managed correctly, do great damage as well. So at a simple level, if people know that money is no object, often it can, they lose their ambition and their drive and their sense of purpose, and that can affect their mental health quite adversely. There's substance abuse and things like that can occur, that obviously, again, it's not exclusively something that happens at the wealth level, with the wealthy, but if people don't have purpose and they're looking to get fulfillment somewhere, then unfortunately that's something that some families do experience, and that's obviously a terrible thing for any family to go through. And then there's conflict over wealth. As I said, it's a double-edged sword. And actually also, people might not expect this one, but particularly wealth inheritors can feel quite a burden from it. At this level of guilt, we didn't deserve this. How do we handle this now? How do we manage this? What are our friends going to say that now we've got this money? So it's very complex. And so really helping families to think about, well, what are they trying to do with it? And how do they get themselves set up in a way, hopefully, to avoid a lot of those pitfalls? And being more philanthropic is a great way to help address some of those areas as well. So, you know, I really enjoy those conversations with clients, because actually being more philanthropic can, I believe, increase their happiness.
Catherine, really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much
for joining us.